welcome to the Logistics Tribe. I'm your host, Boris Felgendreher, and today we will talk about a topic that's particularly close to my heart and that I know is on the minds of a lot of our listeners. And that is the question whether now is actually the right time to start working for a logistics tech startup. I've been involved with supply chain logistics and technology startups for most of my career, and I really enjoyed this lively discussion on the topic with my two guests, Frederik Kraforst and Jonah McIntyre. Frederik is the co-founder and CEO of LogTech startup TradeLink, and Jonah has founded and successfully sold two LogTech startups and is currently working for Transporeon, an established LogTech company. Regardless of whether you're a seasoned professional with more of a corporate background, whether you have some experience in startup environments, or whether you're starting fresh out of university, startups, especially in the supply chain and logistics area, can be a very attractive career opportunity. But with all the uncertainty around the economy, an increasingly difficult startup funding environment, etc., there are a lot of things to consider. So I think today's episode is a very valuable resource for all of you. And on the topic of valuable tools and resources, I'd also like to mention that I just launched a brand new project called the LogTechies Job Board. LogTechies is the first hand-curated job board for the field of logistics technology. And that's where I post the coolest LogTech jobs at those companies that I currently find the most interesting. Right now, the board features really cool LogTech jobs at Sender, at Flush & Post, at FanRide, at TradeLink, at Noise Technologies, and there are many more to come. You can find the LogTechies job board at logtechies.com, LogTechies.com, logtechies.com. Okay, before we get started with today's show, a quick thanks to our supporters Grey Orange. Grey Orange automates warehouse operations through a combination of AI software and autonomous mobile robots. Grey Orange systems are in place at some very prominent companies, such as IKEA or the Danish wholesale goods and furniture retailer Jysk. If you're looking to get your warehouse and fulfillment operations to the next level with the help of autonomous robots and automation, you should definitely have Grey Orange on your list. Check them out at greyorange.com. All right, and now let's move on to the show with Frederik Kraforst and Jonah McIntyre. Enjoy. Hello, Frederik. Hello, Jonah. Welcome to the Logistics Tribe. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Boris.
Frederik, Jonah, as I just mentioned in my brief intro, I want to talk to you today about if now is actually a good time to join a LogTech startup. And let me just sort of quickly set up the scene of why I feel this topic. First of all, I haven't heard this topic being discussed in any length, in any detail, any podcast or any format. So I think it's important for us to talk about it. And you each bring, or we all three of us bring very unique backgrounds to the table that are worth discussing and double clicking on. And then also, we can probably start with discussing how this whole LogTech startup ecosystem has evolved over the last few years, and it's definitely changing right now, right? You can't avoid the fact that the global economy is changing. There's major misalignments between companies and the markets, and it's trickling down into the tech sector. So there's heavy developments and cutbacks and slowdowns and hiring and investments at major tech companies that have so far been pretty much resistant and robust and reluctant to any sort of slowdown, and they're seeing it now. So this is obviously at some point trickling down to the LogTech sector that I have become very fond of and been a champion of for the last few years, because it's been booming so much. So much money has gone into it. So many new talent entered that market. So, and I'm afraid right now that this all might be coming to a screeching halt, which I hope is not the case. So let's double click on that and actually figure out for folks who are working in the traditional logistics sector that are thinking about maybe joining a startup, but also people already working at, in the LogTech startup scene and thinking about, do I stay in there? Should I leave? And do I get cold feet? Should I work for a more established company? Let's double click on all of that, but maybe let's sort of review and zoom out a little bit, and let's just review the last few years, how you experienced the entire LogTech sector developing. And Jonah, let's start with you, because you've been sort of a serial entrepreneur. You've been in this sector for a long, long time. You've seen it all. You've seen the ups and downs that have naturally occurred. And then you've monitored and witnessed this sort of sudden, really LogTech boom that we saw in the last, I want to say, 3 or 4 years. Maybe let's start with you. What's your recap of the last few years of the LogTech sector?
I think that the financial wave of sort of money at 0% interest as the baseline hit us the same way it hit all other sectors, essentially. Money was just looking for a place to go to get any sort of future return at all. And mm-hmm. and that drove a lot, basically. That was maybe 50% of the of the, I don't know, the energy in the room or the air in the room was coming from this flood of money. And a lot of that money went to genuinely interesting things. And then a lot of the money went to things that were more speculative or simply like unfounded in at their base. But we should probably distinguish between two kinds of, you know, log tech. You've got the log part, which is they're essentially logistics companies that are just built for the internet age from day one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you have
you're thinking the flex ports, the senders, the Zencargos of the world. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you take a company like Zencargo, Flexport, or Sender, their operating model is a logistics company. There's a suggestion or a reality that they do it in a technically enabled way better than their competitors. But, you know, mm-hmm. from the outside, you look at the black box as a logistics company. And then there's technology companies that serve the logistics sector, right? And this would be a proliferation of things like our old supply chain visibility. Every supply chain visibility will be there in like 100 years. This still is a hot topic, I guess. The proliferation of sensors and the ability to do tracking down on smaller and smaller levels of granularity, and with smaller granularity between time points of when you get some sort of signal, so whether it's continuous or not, and then just a number of other things. So I think both of those sides receive funding and are doing interesting things, but they head in different directions in the future now because of the change in the funding cycles. So that's my take on it.
Yeah, and just to double click on it, you were stressing the fact that money was so cheaply available and that drove a lot of the investments that went in, but there's also this other element where, like, especially in the last 2 years, the world has really experienced firsthand how analog and how old-fashioned and how complicated supply chains and how brittle they still are. So I think that's what also prompted a lot of investments in that space, not just because money was available, but because also the shortcomings of the way global supply chains are run have become so blatantly obvious. I think that was another driver, probably, right?
And the move to B2C, right? I mean, you'd also say, like, hey, everyone's ordering from home now, been in the last year and a half, and even if money was at, you know, the baseline interest rate was at 6%, that would have fueled it a kind of a Wild West drive to claim that space and create services for that space. So yeah, I agree with you on that, Boris.
Yeah. Frederick, anything to add there? What's your experience? I mean, you're somewhat compared to me and Jonah, you're still somewhat fresh to the sector. What attracted you originally? I mean, how did you come into it, and what were some of the contributing factors why you started a venture in that space, and that is finance now?
Cool. I really like the framework that you used, Jonah, with the lock and the tech piece. I think another way to look at our discussion is, should you join a logistic tech company at all? And that's between startup and logistics, right? So that's two questions. And then the other question, the third question is, should you do it right now? So then there's a timing piece. We started in 2020. So we just a couple of months before everyone was talking about supply chain and logistics, just because of what we experienced. But when we started, we didn't know that yet. What we really were attracted to is the sheer size of the problem. So we really enjoyed thinking about, I think it's about 107 trillion of goods that we're moving across our B2B supply chains in Europe and North America. So this is just an unimaginable size. And we really enjoyed thinking about how that is being aligned and communicated right now. And this just seems to be that needs to be solved, right? That's something that we wanted to work on. And I think in logistics or supply chain, because the market is just so big and the problems are so big, you have a chance to build a world-changing company, right? And that's something that really attracted us.
Yeah, one thing I want to add to that is the fact that something that I've observed, in which you, Frederick, are a perfect example of, is that we've seen this influx of founders that are not from the logistics space or from the supply chain space. Yeah. I mean, you can name just any of the even very successful companies that have made it, that have got funding and that built major companies, they were all started by people that are completely agnostic or not from the industry at all, which I find most fascinating. So that's the first time in history, basically, that whole space attracted people from the outside world, where in the past, you know, you've got some ideas and some trials and some experiments and some funding from inside mm-hmm. of the industry. Now that's completely reversed. That I found one of the most exciting, interesting trends.
Yeah. I think what we experience is in logistics or supply chain, it's really complex, right? You really need to love to get into that and really understand it. And we're still learning. we're still learning stuff, and we're still being corrected by people we talk to because we use the wrong lingo or we missed a detail. So I think you really need to be, if you're from outside the company, outside the industry, you really need to love learning and learning and listening and listening. For us, it was a coincidence, I think. We had initial insight from a co-founder because he founded an e-commerce company, that something can be done better. And then we just were curious and started investigating and came to a lot of problems. And the interesting piece was that people were really open to talk about it because I think they also had the feeling that it didn't get enough attention yet. So we're very open to discuss this, especially in the logistics part of supply chain, right? Which was underserved with attention, or still is.
Yeah. Also, you also need a certain, I mean, naivete is probably the wrong word, but it's some sort of fresh mind, a beginner's mind, right? You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you know, there's so many people in the industry that are just old and entrenched and think about the way things are done in the old traditional ways. And sometimes it just takes an outsider to just come in there and think, wow, this is a huge space. There's a huge potential here. And this is so analog. Let's jump in here with a naive beginner's mind. That's very refreshing. That sometimes jumpstarts things. Just the way that Elon Musk jumped into the automotive industry, right? It's probably a bad example.
Space. Well, I think his space, jump into space is actually more interesting because you know, you have a guy who says, "Yeah, I'm gonna do this for a fraction of the cost with a ship that comes back and lands itself, and it's gonna use like a it's like a tenth of the moving parts or something." And you go, "Okay, so what's your background?" And he's like, "Well, I did a software company."
Yeah, come on. Yeah. So that trickled down into the LogTech space, I feel, because I've talked to so many successful founders who had no idea. And then just like kind of jumped into the deep end of the pool and became fascinated and became experts really, really quickly on the topic. Right. Yeah. So it's sometimes you overestimate how long it takes to actually get smart on stuff. It can get super quick if you're really onto something and really dive down into a niche.
But I think there's also this interesting point that comes really quickly once you've found sort of your initial idea and you got some validation on this, then you realize how long that took you and you don't want everyone to do the same. So then you switch, right? Then you want the people from the industry to join you and you tell them what you found out. And that's something you really need afterwards. Like probably Elon Musk is hiring a lot of people from BMW right now. So I think that changes quickly then.
Yeah. Have you reached that point yet with your shop, Frederick? I mean, are you already looking to hire sort of entrenched expertise?
For sure. Yeah. We try to mix them. Because I think if you have a team that's composed of different experience, that's super helpful. But teaching everyone that joins how logistics and supply chain works, that's a long process. Yeah. So we try to speed that up.
Yeah. What do you make of the fact that, as I mentioned before, this trickling down of the hiring slowdown, even some layoffs? I mean, we've seen some layoffs arrive in the LogTech space. I mean, most prominent cases were fast delivery service, right? Like Gorillas, GoPuff, Getir, they had major layoffs, even in headquarters, not just drivers and not pulling back out of markets, but actually support staff and people in the headquarters in Berlin. And that's sort of disquieting and worrying. But that's probably a unique example because they came out of nowhere. They rose to exorbitant evaluations and just bloated operations and had to cut back accordingly. But that's probably a bad example. But I could see this affecting the entire sector where people just get spooked, right? Because you hear these headlines and you don't want to get axed. I mean, regardless of how talented you are and how quickly you find a new job, nobody wants to get in a situation where your rug is being pulled from under you. That's a really, really, it's a damper. It's going to affect the way you, Frederick, and others are being able to hire people. I think it's going to have a real impact. What do you feel? I mean, you have conversations right now with people that are interested in joining you. What do you feel? Is that already sinking in? Are people becoming more cautious, or are they just as willing to jump into an adventure as they were before all of this started turning south?
I think Jonah made a good point that you need to look at the reasons. So people are asking, right? They're asking how safe is it to work at your company? But to look at the examples you brought, I think some of them, maybe the fundamentals of the business model were not there, right? But they got funding. So that's something you want to take out of the equation because they're not relevant. Because obviously I think I have a sound business model, right? And when we interview, you should ask me about that. And the other piece is every company, when markets go up and demand goes up, all companies have plans to serve that demand. And if that suddenly crashes, you need to adjust, right? That's not just logistics, that's everywhere. So I think that's a normal movement that can happen to you wherever you work. When we're having these discussions right now, I think the first question is, do you want to work at a startup in the first place, if you're the right person for a startup? And if you are, and let's say, in an example, you started at let's take a great company, a big company that was hiring a lot. Let's say Project 44, for example. You started there half a year ago, and maybe they overhired, and now they find out that they have too many positions, too many people for the positions. So you're being made let go. Now you're in the market. You have half a year of experience at a startup who probably did a lot of things really right. You learned a lot that you wouldn't have learned before. Your employability actually went up. If you're the right person to work at a startup, now you're even more likely to go to a great startup, right? Because you already made a decision you want to work at a startup. And I'd probably hire you even more likely now than I did before you started at Project 44. So I think that's also a way to look at it. If you are the right person for a startup, I think every day you're not doing that, you're wasting part of your life. Because your employability will just go up.
Yeah, so that's an interesting theory that you, once you're in it, and then even if you get axed or if you're making being made redundant, once you're in it, you stay in it. I can also envision the opposite being the case, where you get spooked and you get burned and you don't want another one of those instances on your resume, which will is still being looked down upon if you stayed in a place for less than a year or what have you. And you don't want to take risks, and then you're going to go back to DB Schenker or Kuno Nagel just to for a few years just to smooth things out again. Jonah, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think you see that in other careers. So if you worked in, let's say you went and worked at you use Project 44, it's a really well-known name. So it, you know, if the equivalent would be if you went and worked for something like Goldman Sachs and you were there for 4 months and then you were fired. Yeah, that looks bad. If you were there for 18 months, 2 years, you lose your job. Like, if you want to stay in the sector, you're probably going to be able to parlay that into, you know, hire in another investment bank. I think the thing that if I was coaching somebody through, let's say I was talking to somebody who worked at either a standard software company. So they worked at SAP, for example, and they were thinking about going to a new technology provider or and the technology provider would accept them. Or I was talking to somebody who worked at, I don't know, Hapag-Lloyd, and they were thinking about going to Zencargo or something like that. So the couple things I would be pointing out. So one is, it's not so much a downturn in the economy, I think, as it's the change in the underlying interest rate that, you know, we were in a situation where if a startup's all of their future free cash flow was, say, 20 years in the future, that's when they're actually going to start being profitable and making really big money. That was fine because there was no discount between now and 20 years from now. I mean, if you paid me $1 million back as an investor 20 years from now, that was basically the same as $1 million today, because there was the interest rate and the inflation rate were essentially zero. But that's not the case anymore. So suddenly a long bet, which, like, take a public company like Uber, posted their first free cash flow this quarter, right? And their free cash flow was like 0.1% EBITDA. I mean, it's nothing, right? It's nothing. And so that suddenly is totally unacceptable in the new sort of financial reality. And I think that causes a more, because the downturn in the economy, that'll swing back. That's a 18 months kind of painful period, and then it comes back, and it's not going to swing that much. Maybe that's a small retraction. This reset to interest rates that are more like what we had before the great financial crisis, that I think is more important. And that'd be the first thing. And the second thing is, like, okay, they're laying people off, but you know, the difference between sort of BMW and Tesla is more the growth trajectory. Anyway, so, like, you didn't get laid off in BMW, but you weren't gonna climb the ladder very quickly either. You know, growing companies afford you that opportunity. If you're in a company that hires 30-40% new staff in a year, you got a pretty good chance of getting promoted just by force of numbers. So I wouldn't be too worried about the that side of the layoffs. I'd be more worried about and it comes back to stock options. Just to mention, I know we'll get to remuneration eventually, but we talk about stock options with this reset in interest rates. The valuations have to go down. I mean, just the math, like, the valuations go down. And it's not, those stock options just are less in value for two reasons. One is, like, the exit price will be lower. But the second is almost every investor has liquidation preferences on their shares. So they're going to get a certain amount of money. It, like, you could be a billion valuation or 100 million valuation, and they've got a sort of a guarantee of, say, 90 million. So they could have, it doesn't matter, right? Like, they could say they have 10% shares, but they've got a guarantee of the first 90 million, something like that. That's the preference, liquidation preference effect. And in effect, what that means is all this rush to invest that happened right before interest rates have gone up has locked in a higher share of the future value of these companies to the investors. Some of them made a mistake and invested. Others were smart enough to lock in through liquidation preferences, essentially a higher stake in the business than it looks like on paper, because when they exit at a lower valuation, the liquidation preferences will bring them back, and that'll fall to ESOP, you know, the employee stock option holders for sure.
Yeah, since we're on the topic, let's stay on the topic of options for a second before we start talking about just the general incentives of working for a startup and what the pros and cons are. But let's linger on the topic of the financial incentives that existed in the past, why somebody even would consider working for a startup regardless of how exciting the job is. But you couldn't separate that from an incentive of people thinking, well, maybe this place is going some places, and maybe I'll just be a millionaire one day if I play my cards right, and I'm an early employee, I get my options. I mean, there's plenty of examples, especially in Silicon Valley, where that was the case, and a lot of people were sort of in their back of their heads had that as one of the motivations. Let's talk about that. Maybe, Fredrik, what's your point of view? I know all of the people, or most of the people in your company, also are rewarded with stock options. Is that, and you're in Germany, so there's whole lots of complications. We could talk about differences in the markets for stock options, but is that, do you feel that that's a motivator? I mean, are people coming into the door, applicants asking specifically for that? Are they motivated by that? Or is it mainly a US thing where people are super focused on getting options and getting equity and sort of rising up? Is that even a thing here? Maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit.
I think when I talk about this, is from a perspective of an early stage company, right? And this might change throughout our growth path. Right now we're 2 years old. And I think there's no person at TradeLink that's here for the money. Like at this stage, people don't come because they think they're going to be millionaires at some point. So the way we think about this is your own part of potentially building legacy, and you want to be part of that trajectory. And there's a chance that you don't have to work afterwards anymore, right? But that's a potential scenario that you don't work for. That's just a consequence of you being successful and learning a lot and having a steep trajectory. So we don't really have these discussions around, okay, is that going to be worth enough? How much is it going to be worth? Also because we're at the stage where ideally there's a 10, 20, 30, 40 X on what we do, right? We will grow. Our idea is to grow a lot, right? If you're a later stage company, back to what Jonah said, then maybe you already locked in too much valuation and you don't have that chance to grow 10 X or 20 X. And suddenly it becomes really relevant what the value is today. For us, it's really about, is it going to be 20, 30, whatever the number is, right? Is this going to be getting really, really big? And I think that's what's motivating everyone right now. But yeah, not the money. And I think if you're coming for the money in the first place, then you're probably not going to be successful anyway at a startup.
Yeah, but you are going to have the discussion, because if someone is considering working for a large organization, they are going to have bigger salaries there, right? You are going to, if you're just starting off, you're in a position you can't offer the same level of salary that that a large company can offer. So there's something else, and typically your conversation you have is, well, your base salary isn't that high, but here's some equity that could be worth something in the future, right? You're having that conversation, right? So you are dangling that carrot in front of potential applicants, or no?
I think the discussion starts with what's important to you in life. Do you want to learn? Do you want to have an exponential career track? Do you want to be part of building legacy? Then you probably should join. Then we talk about your compensation. It's likely going to be lower than what you earn in a classical larger company. However, in a startup, impact is excessively rewarded more than CV or experience. So you have the chance to earn a lot more than in your current role if you're excellent. And I won't wait 3 years or 4 years till you have the right level. If you are awesome and you perform really well, I give you infinite responsibility and you'll be equivalently rewarded for that. So you might make a lot more than you did before, but you're taking that risk.
Yeah, and that conversation around salary versus options and so forth is somewhat easy for someone just starting off or early in their career, right, where it's not that much of an arbitrage. But it's a different story with someone who's been working for 20 years at Kuhn & Nagel or Hapag-Lloyd or what have you, and is now considering moving into a role at a tech startup. That's going to be a major cut. That's a different story. Jonah, have you experienced situations like that? And what was the motivations for people doing that? And what was your major selling point in getting people like that to join?
Yeah, so it really depends on the stage of the startup. And that's actually probably a key for the listeners who are, again, if we go back to these two people, they work at SAP, they work at Hapag-Lloyd, they're considering moving to a startup that somebody knows or recommended to them or something, you know, the first, one of the first questions to ask is what's the stage of the startup, right? So if it's a pre-revenue startup, they don't have money to pay you your market salary. It doesn't matter what guarantees they give you. It's highly risky. You're going to be motivated by having a stake in the final, outcome of that business. That just, that's the only way that you could, obviously the intrinsic motivation is there, but the only way that they can compensate you for the risk and the foregone salary is to give you a stake in the business, right? And then as it heads more towards a, just a operating business, if I think about a company like Zen Cargo today, you know, they're recruiting away people who are, they're not just in, you know, Hapag-Lloyd or something. They're like leaders of those companies. So you're getting the regional VP, you're getting the sales VP, you're getting the head of partnerships, you know, Project 44, you know, hired the Gartner lead analyst for their space, right? So you don't do that with, I mean, I those people are going to get paid a lot of money no matter what, right? They don't come over with a pay cut, they come over with a pay raise or at least parity plus the things that Frederick's mentioning. I know for me, when I've recruited in the past, the way that I was approaching it was, we're going to be at parity with market so that the person doesn't have this constant conflict within themselves of, oh, but you know, I could be making like 5,000 euros more. That's the distraction compared to the cost just wasn't, just the trade-off didn't make sense to me. So we wanted to be at parity on direct compensation, but we couldn't, there's no way we can make it less risky. Like that, it just is what it is, right? And because people would say, well, what's your runway? It was like 9 months, 12 months, something like that, right? It's like, yeah, it's risky. But what we compensate the risk for then, or the risk with, was more the autonomy of the role. All the things Frederick just mentioned, like no one would prevent you from going as fast as you possibly can, right? Like if, as we grow, you'll always be assumed to be the person in charge of your area. You know, you can work any way you want. You can work wherever you want. We were remote first. Before it was fashionable because people didn't want to die, we were remote first. And through these combination of like the non-monetary incentives, we were able to recruit away like, you know, great people, actually. I think that worked.
Yeah, but the sort of incentive of having autonomy and being your sort of own boss, or like can describe or kind of niche and carve out your own space. I mean, if you reached a certain level inside a large organization, there becomes more autonomy, right? You have your space and you've got your freedoms, and it's not like you're a small cog of the or am I saying this wrong? Does it get harder to recruit people that have risen up the ranks and have therefore gained a sort of level of autonomy that you don't have if you're early on?
I think the challenge that I faced with those people, so I'll give you like I have a clear example of someone in my mind who I wanted to hire as a head of sales. And this person was like, yeah, I make 250 base and I make another 200 in variable. So I have a $450,000 a year compensation. And in my mind, that actually wasn't the deal breaker. The deal breaker was that those people don't think in terms of individual contributors. They think in terms of teams. So if I look at this person, there was no chance at all that this person was going to come to us if we didn't give him a team of say 10 people immediately, right? So this person was not going to do something themselves. They were going to essentially, you know, be the general over an army, not go out to the front line. And I think that actually was the in terms of timing, it wasn't that we couldn't pay him. It was in this case, it was a man, just to be clear. So we couldn't pay him. It was that aspect.
That's an interesting point, because you, as a potential employee for a startup, you don't only have to evaluate the potential risk you're facing with this thing going out of business or not working out, but you also have to calculate the risk of you not thriving in that environment and not have you being actually successful, because it's quite a different animal, right? So you're having to deal with both of these risks. Frederick?
I think it's a completely different job, right? If you have an established product, established market, and you need to maintain what already works and maybe advance it a little bit and make sure reporting lines work, versus building something from the ground, right? Or taking something and putting that into the next evolution of that stage, like, for example, a head of sales that comes when there are 10 people versus managing 300 people, that's a completely different job, I think. So that's something to check for. Mm-hmm. I'd love to make a point as well to what you said, Jonah, because I tend to disagree a little bit that people are really looking at their, or that all people are looking at their market value and sort of what's the fair value, and I want to optimize for that. And then they are trying to fit in what is the value of that, what is the value of that. For me, I tend to think about this as what am I currently doing with my life? How much do I love it? How passionate am I about it? And for me, a lot of people find startup to be the right thing for that. And then we have this discussion where at the early stage, right? And I'm clear about this is going to change, and it's already changing in terms of how you pay. But it's really about, okay, what do you need in your life stage, right? It's about, you won't come if you have a house and if you have family. And you should think about this as to what is what I need for my life? Am I going to get it from that company? And then they weigh in on what am I lacking on the upside in another scenario, and how much can I strive here? So I think I don't think people are necessarily optimizing for that number. But when they join us, at least they're optimizing.
It's part of the equation, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think they satisfy for it, essentially. The thing I experienced anyway was that if you get at least in the range of their market salary, mm-hmm. it takes away a lot of the potential stressor and noises. You know, their spouse isn't reminding them that they're underpaid. You know, when a recruiter contacts them, which happens for everybody who has any capability at all right now, right? when a recruiter contacts them, they're not constantly being bombarded with this, like, you are underpaid. And it's not that I totally agree with you, Frederick. I'm just saying that my experience was that the small delta there of like, well, I want to pay them 10% less than market, but I ended up creating this tension, which was like, well, let's just pay them market and then expect them to work 20% harder.
Well, let's talk very realistically about, let's just use that example again of someone that's been at a larger company, be it a tech company, like a large enterprise software company, let's say, or a logistics provider of some size, that is considering working for a startup that's new, that's sort of smallish, but has big upside potential. What's the biggest selling point? How should this person think about what's attractive about a startup? Why should they even bother? Why should they do this? What's in it for them, Freddie? Well, how would you best crystallize and describe it? Why that's an option to consider, and what sort of person would actually thrive and mm-hmm. make a right decision by going with a startup?
Cool. I think, first of all, you're probably already unhappy if you're at a large corporate. And you think, that's probably a requirement. That makes it more like...
No,
I'm not saying you're generally...
Yes, but there are plenty of happy people there. Oh, if you're looking, you mean?
Yeah, if we have this conversation, there is likely that you wonder whether you should stay at a corporate, right? That's I'm not saying... people can be extremely happy at a corporate, right? There's a lot of benefits to mm-hmm, that. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, if we have this discussion, then you probably already came to the conclusion that there might be something else that you want to do. That mm-hmm. is different.
Got it. Okay.
And then I'll weigh in on this, and I'll tell you, okay, for us, we are very invested in personal growth, right? We want to make sure that it's all about how fast can you grow? What do you need to acquire in terms of your skills? How can we help you to succeed? Then it's all about infinite responsibility. So if you're good at what you do, we'll constantly make sure you grow and you get more and more responsibility, because there's just too much to do, right? There's just too much to handle. So you will make sure that the people that perform get more responsibility. Of course, there's this being part of a big building legacy and being rewarded for that if that succeeds, right? If we're successful as we want to be, you likely don't have to work after this anymore, right? But that shouldn't be your primary motive. That's just a nice side effect of us being successful. And you work with passionate people. I mean, people who love what they do, and every day you have this constant buzz, and people are really into what they are doing. But then you also, at the flip side, there's this constant buzz, right? This doesn't stop. Like, there is no separation, mm-hmm. clear separation. That's something that you need to be willing to want to do.
John, anything to add there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not doing it. So, right, like, I'm no longer at a startup because we sold our startup. But I still am looking for the same kind of staff, essentially, the same kind mm-hmm. of teammates and hiring a lot. This is going to sound a little weird, but I try to make the job sound as hard as possible, which it is. I mean, especially in the startup environment, it's just brutally, unrelentingly hard. And contrast that with their other options. So if they want to go work for Hapag-Lloyd, for example, I have no doubt that they'll succeed, right? They have essentially zero chance of losing their job in the next year at these sort of stable large corporates. But I take the position that when you succeed with a small goal like that, the success will make you smaller essentially as a person. Yeah. That by having selected goals which were so easily accomplished, you know deep down inside that you're making yourself weaker, and that you'll build your career, but not just your career, just your sense of self, right? Your pride in yourself. You'll build that by taking on goals which are failable, right? That you it's possible that you'll come work for us, and though you try your best, we'll decide after a year, not that we're closing the business, but that you didn't cut it, right? Like you weren't good enough for the team, actually, or that we'll all try our best, but the market will decide that we didn't cut it as a group, right? Mm-hmm. And only by participating in something that has the potential to fail, not by chance, not because lightning struck, but because you weren't good enough, or we weren't good enough, only through that is the success actually like affirming to your sense of self. And if I can find people who, and there are people, right? Like if you can find people who that they see and live with the embodiment of like that challenge, those are people I want to work with. Now, like sometimes they don't have exactly the right skill sets, but it's just like, I'm trying to figure out people I want to spend the next, the next several years, 55 hours a week with. Mm-hmm. And those are people I want. The people who are like, yeah, I want to be safe. And it's like, well, it's not safe here. I mean, sorry, right? Like, it just isn't. Yeah. And I'm not gonna try to make it safe. And I'm not gonna try to describe it like, oh, it's not safe, but you'll like these other things. I'm like, yeah, it's not safe. And if you should be coming here because you want it to not be safe.
That's actually a great point for startup founders not to sugarcoat things and being too eager to hire great personnel on board and having some real straight talk with them and really like opening up the kimono and tell them how it really is. But let's talk about how that really is. I mean, we've all worked in both more of a corporate environment as well as in a startup environment. From your experience, is that old adage or that old picture still true that you work twice as hard as a startup? It's just more, it's brutal, the way you described it, Jonah. Or is that sort of a myth that the workload or the stress that comes about is not as bad after all? Jonah, or maybe Frederick, what's your take? What's your experience and what do you see? How do people cope? is the workload that much harder in your place than it is? It's a company that's been around for 20 years?
That's a good question that I probably can't answer totally, but I think a lot of the people that we hire already did more than they needed to do in their old role, right? They are already not mm-hmm. saying at 5 o'clock, I'm going to go home now, but they had this intrinsic motivation to reach something. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people already come with that mindset. Nevertheless, especially when we hire from corporate or classical industry, we have this conversation around saying, look, it's probably going to be harder. I can't tell you how much you need to work because at the end of the day, I'm looking at impact, right? And we'll look at that. I'm not going to bother you on the weekend likely unless there's something really critical. Then I want you to help me. But that happens like once every whatever year. And also depends on your position. But then we have this interesting realization that we thought we talked about it. But apparently we had different ideas of what it means that is really intense. So we had that in a couple of instances where we thought we talked about it, but there was still a gap in expectation and it was too intense, right? So that can happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Overall, I think if you prefer to work 9 to 5 and that's sort of what you want to do, then probably don't join, at least not an early stage startup.
Yeah. I actually think the hours, although the hours are undoubtedly higher at startups, you know, in part for a lot of reasons, but, you know, in part because the mission's bigger and you have, there's a sort of magic gap which has to be closed somehow, which is you have competitors who are already in the market, they have established things, whatever that is, and you have less people, less money, less brand, less whatever, less product, less service, and you have to somehow close that gap. And the only way that I figured out how to do that would be you have smarter people because there are smaller groups, so you can select harder for smarter people. And they work more hours. I mean, it's the only way that I see to do it. But you also have the just basic stuff. Like you work at BMW, you have an HR department who's like tasked with stopping people from working overtime. You know, they're sort of a like it's it's structurally they're intending to block that, whereas, and maybe they don't do it all the time, but they at least make an effort, whereas that doesn't, I've never really met a successful startup where they said, yeah, we hired this person in HR to block people from working extra hours. Does it work?
But it does make sense to offer some sort of work-life balance, because you could also run the risk of attracting people that are just so super intense, that are workaholics, and they just burn themselves out, and that's not in your interest either, right? So you got to watch out for those types that also have a propensity to show up at a startup, right?
I would hire them. I mean, I consider that...
You would hire them for 2 years? That's
right. Well, I consider that burnout. So I have sort of an odd look at the work-life balance. I just don't see that as a topic for me. But let's take it at face value, Boris. So let's say I had somebody in front of me, and I knew that they would work intensely. They've got the right skills and everything. They're going to work super intensely for 2 years, and then they really are burned out, and they'll have to take time off or leave or something. You know, 2 years in startup life, it's like as if I were to tell you that in 2100 we're going to have a food shortage on Mars. It's just so far, it's a problem that's so far in the future, that's so contingent on other things, that it's not worth worrying about right now. That's how I would look at it.
Can I say something that's opposing that? Because I find that a very drastic rational view.
Please.
I think I first of all, I agree with you that if you find someone who is extremely driven and who just doesn't feel like they need to separate something really hard, then that I'd love to have that person as well. And I think we have a lot of these people. But I think people don't burn out because they work too much, right? People burn out because they are not handling a certain piece of ambiguity, or because you are constantly changing direction, because you are not managing them well, because they don't have purpose. So that's something I think is in our responsibility to make sure that these people have, or have a discussion with them about why they don't have it, and sort of protect them in that way, maybe to weigh this perspective.
Makes sense. Yeah. Well, just to summarize it, just as a piece of advice for someone that's in a later part of their career and has worked not in a startup environment, but is now looking to work at a startup, just to go back to our opening question, whether now is a good timing. Yeah. Can you say that now is a good time for that type of person to go into that space right now, and why? Jonah, I'll start with you. Is it a good time, and why?
So I think if you were if you could live your life over a century or something, I would say no. The good time would be when there's a flood of money coming in and the economy is about to go into high growth mode, right? So that would have been a good time. But given that that's not the way life works, it's sort of the reverse is the question. Is now a good time for your life, not for the economy. And then I probably am going to say what Frederick would say as well, is just if now's the time for you, if this is the time you want to block out a couple of years and give it a try, especially if you're later in your career, as you said, Boris, you can go back to your career. I mean, they right. will accept you, right? So that's right. just try it, and, you know, introspect about what you want in your career and at this moment, and if that's what you want to try, then try it.
And also, in a way, this is a self-weeding out process where the only jobs you find right now are with solid companies that are hiring that have a growth path, right? And you're not running into a risk where there's just frivolous hiring going on and your job makes no sense and it's going to be gone. And so you have that situation too, where the only jobs at companies right now, I mean, you obviously maybe you have to do more diligence than you have in the past, but also the only jobs that you could potentially get right now are with jobs that are, you know, that are somewhat secure even in that space.
I think correct. Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think it became easier in that sense. And typically, you know, in a downturn, some of the most successful companies have been founded, right? You're after the .com bust and Airbnb, Amazon, they all started hard times because they sort of had to develop a sound business model and be prudent about their spending and have the best people on board, stretch the people they have on board. So if you do more due diligence, I think that's right. But I don't think the fundamentals changed. So the market is ripe for a new wave of technology. The problem is big enough and the money is still flowing in, right? We just have a detraction from what happened. But in Q2 this year, even after this first wave of correction, we still had more VC funding than in 2020, any quarter, right? So we are talking at, okay, 21, 22, that was crazy, right? And that doesn't consist. This is not consistent anymore. but we're still having a lot of money, and VCs, looking at how much money VCs have at their disposal, that is actually higher than ever, right? Because they have that money right now. So fundamentals didn't change, valuations came down, and it might be harder to raise for the next, whatever, nobody knows, year, 2 years. But yeah, if you find a good company, I don't think the why now changed.
Yeah, so that was the discussion around folks that have been in the industry that at a later stage of their career. I was recently approached, so I was at an event, at a logistics and supply chain event a couple of months ago, and I was approached by a student who's studying logistics and supply chain, and he wanted career advice. So he was a fan of the podcast that I do. And so he came up and we took a picture. It was kind of cool. And he wanted career advice from me.
You have groupies now, man. That's where you've arrived at. Yeah.
That's right. Look at that. Anyway, that was sort of fun. And he asked me for career advice, which was pretty nice. I volunteered career advice, and he asked me whether after his studies he should work for he was naming a particular logistics provider that had a big name. And he said, or if that's a good idea. And my first response was, you know what, if I was in your shoes, I would work at a real cool LogTech startup, because the experience you get there is invaluable. This is a stage in your life where, like we mentioned earlier, you don't have the mortgage, you don't have the three kids, you're still somewhat unbound and free, and you could take risks and chances, and the rewards for working at a startup are that much higher. Plus, combine that with the fact that you already have the basic logistics and supply chain knowledge from your studies, and now you apply it at a LogTech startup. That's a golden combination. So my advice for that person was unequivocally, you go for a startup. Let me know when you're ready, and I'll hook you up with the right people. I have insights into what companies are good. You know, I mean that for real. So that was my offer to him. But any other advice or anything you would add to folks that are just entering the space?
So in that situation, Boris, you're describing someone's new to the industry. They're going to have a hard time distinguishing the truly interesting startup from the not interesting. Someone who's in the industry is going to have a easier time figuring that out, because either they have the more expertise themselves or they have a network they can ask. And for virtually any significant size startup, someone who's in the industry is going to be able to find somebody who's a customer, an employee, an ex-employee of these people. It's just, or an investor or something. So I think the best thing they can do is try to find a buddy or a mentor or somebody like this person who found you at the event to guide them in that regard. Even if it's just a black ball, white ball type veto type effect, or it's just, nothing else. They just say, hey, just don't go to this company. Or hey, if you can go to this company, that would already change their odds in their favor.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you have mentioned this, and I don't know if you're aware, Jonah, but I know Frederick is for sure that I've recently launched a job board for the LogTech industry.
Right.
It's called LogTech, as you may have seen it. And that's actually the model that I use there, which is nobody's posting jobs on that job board that I haven't personally curated. So I personally go to the companies that I think those are great companies to work for. And then I tease out and sort of filtrate the best jobs and present it on that job board. I think there's a need for that sort of sifting and hand curation. It is a trial. It's an experiment right now. Let's see how it goes. But I think the instincts are aligned with what you just said, especially not just for young people coming into the industry, but someone in general. Like, I'm very close to that whole scene because I talk to these founders all the time, and I have a sense of who's bullshitting and who's real. And I'll try to sort of pass that expertise on and be of service. So I'll leave a link in the show notes to the LogTechies job board, whoever's interested.
Yeah.
That's my little plug.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Frederick, anything you wanted to add there to that part of the equation?
Sure. Jumping to the what should a junior person at the beginning of their career join a startup? I think thinking about where you want to be in life and about your career success, and what is going to determine your success is really important, right? And if you start, like, your initial pay is not determining where you're going to end up, right? Where you're going to end up is determined by what you learn, how much impact you created, how much responsibility you had, how fast, who you worked with, and the experience you made there. And I think especially at the beginning, where you have little downside because you have little dependencies in most cases in your life, where you can easily invest time and effort into a startup, that's a great time to start. And then I think a good quiet guiding question, if there's so many benefits to the one starting the career or also mid or end of their career, is what's the worst thing that can happen, right? So if it doesn't work after a year or whatsoever, you still learned a lot more than you would learn somewhere else. Your employability actually went up right? So I think that's something that to take into account.
You just have to get over that hump where you have to describe to your family or friends who you work for. It's great to say I work for SAP or Oracle or what have you, and a big name is like, oh, wow, you got hired there. Oh, look at you. As opposed to saying, well, I work for this company, it's called, and they say, who, what? Like, what do they do? You have to explain it. You have to get over that hump. But I would just add to everything you said was right. And I would also add to it, don't underestimate the confidence that comes along with working for a startup and actually making that work and taking on responsibility early on. That is just a self-perpetuating thing that keeps going on and on. When you build that confidence early on in the first couple of years, it just goes from there. As opposed to where you end up in a very large organization and you have your small little piece of the pie that's already been done by somebody else in the past, you don't gain the same level of confidence. There's just no way that happens. So that's oftentimes underestimated, that it's a great way to build confidence. Yeah, totally agree. It seems like we're all very, very bullish. We have been all along, but now we're still bullish even in that downturn with everything, with all the caveats we just mentioned. So hopefully this was helpful to people who are thinking about whether this is the right time now in general at all to join a startup in the LogTech space. And if now is the right time, whether you're in a seasoned career or whether you're fresh, I hope there was something here for everybody today. But Frederick, Jonah, thank you very much for your participation. I hope we'll see each other again. I feel that this wasn't everything that's supposed to be said about this topic. I think there's a lot more left on the table that we could touch on a later point maybe. But thanks for being on again.
Thanks, Boris.
All right. That was the Logistics Tribe podcast episode with Frederick Kraforst and Jonah McIntyre. If you're all inspired now to go work for a LogTech startup, a good place to start looking is the LogTechies job board that I mentioned during this episode. You can find it at logtechies.com. All right, that's it for today's show. I hope you will join us again next week. I'm Boris Felgendreher. Until next time.